From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore how political conventions have changed over time and look back on some memorable convention moments. We'll learn about stink bugs and what to do if you find one in your home. Then we'll talk about some of the best hikes in Wisconsin.
This state is rich with a wide variety of terrain. It's a gold mine, and I encourage everybody to get out and mine it.
Plus, after years of sharing his love for music with WUWM listeners as the host of It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music, Bob Reitman signs off.
I've learned so much after all those years of radio coming over here. I have learned so much about music, found artists that I'd never heard of.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The city of Milwaukee is preparing to host the Republican National Convention this July. More than 50,000 people are expected to come to Milwaukee for the four-day event when Republicans will officially nominate their candidate for president. The role of political conventions in modern America is a tradition that has lost a little luster now that we hold primary elections and have a pretty good idea of who the nominee will be well ahead of time. So, do conventions still matter? To help us look back at influential moments in convention history, I spoke with Kenneth Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About History series. I want to look back at the role of conventions overall. So, historically, what has that role been for Americans?
Well, you have to talk about historically in sort of two phases, because for much of the early history of the presidency, there was no convention. There was no convention to nominate Thomas Jefferson or some of the early presidents. It really came about in the 1830s, curiously because of a third party called the Anti-Masonic Party, which had a decision to hold a convention. Before that time, presidential nominees were made essentially by party members in what they called the caucus. And up until the 1830s, it was known as King Caucus. You have to remember a little bit that people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison all railed against parties. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about parties. And Washington in particular was very worried about the future of American politics if it devolved into what he called factions. But of course it did almost immediately, because that is the way politics naturally works. It's interesting because the movement towards the convention was an early form of people wanting more democracy, not allowing powerful men, and of course they all were men, choosing other men, to make these decisions. They wanted to give it more of a voice to the people. And so the idea of the convention comes about in 1830. As I mentioned, the first one was actually a third party of sorts called the Anti-Masonic Party. This was a group of men who believed that the masonry was a dangerous conspiracy against America. So that is an idea that goes back to our political roots as well, the idea that there are powerful secret organizations running things. Among the anti-Masons, I should point out, was a future president of the United States, Millard Fillmore. So this idea was actually picked up then by the two other key parties at the time, the Democrats, and at that time it was the Whig Party. Later, of course, the Republican Party is invented.
So we have the start of nominating conventions with the Anti-Masonic Convention, and another third-party significance convention I'd like to point to is 1912, the Republican Convention. So this is Theodore Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party, which many would argue is the most successful third-party campaign.
It was absolutely the most successful third party campaign. Roosevelt, as a third party candidate, actually finished second in the balloting that year to Woodrow Wilson, who ultimately became the president. And that's a really fascinating election. Just to fill in a little bit, between 1830 and 1912, But parties had evolved, obviously. The Republican Party came into existence in the 1850s. Its first successful presidential nominee, of course, Abraham Lincoln in 1860. But this was not still very much men getting together in closed rooms and making the big decisions. What we think of as the primary process today really did not exist until the 20th century. It was a sort of an outgrowth of the progressive movement that wanted to increase the amount of democracy. But that's what made the convention still so important for most of American political history. This really was the place where, sometimes in so-called smoke-filled rooms, the decisions were made about who the candidate would be, and very often also, very importantly, who the vice presidential candidate would be. In 1912, you have an interesting situation because you do have the Republican Party divided very, very sharply between the sitting incumbent president, William Howard Taft, and President Theodore Roosevelt, who'd left office and decided 4 years later that he wanted to go back. He wasn't particularly happy with his successor Taft, and he chose to run again. And the Republican convention was split very seriously. They did nominate Taft. Roosevelt goes ahead and starts his own party, the Progressive Party, better known as the Bull Moose Party, because Roosevelt had actually been shot and declared to the journalists that he was as strong and healthy as a bull moose.
And that actually happened here in Milwaukee, where he was shot.
That is correct. So a piece of presidential history right there. And so this was an extraordinary moment in American political history, and perhaps one of the most extraordinary elections in history. I contend that Wilson really wins the election that year. He had a very, very stunning electoral victory. But when you look at the states that had gone Republican in the previous two elections that went to Wilson, it was because Taft and Roosevelt clearly split the vote in 1912, the Republican vote. If one or the other of them had dropped out of the race, it's a good, you can make a good case that Wilson would not have won the 1912 election. So here's a quick case clearly of a third party candidate actually throwing the whole election into chaos.
Going forward a bit to 1932, the Democratic Convention. So the country is in the midst of the Great Depression, and Democrats were hopefully set up to take over the GOP's long hold on the White House. And it took a bit of time, but eventually FDR was anointed on the fourth ballot, and this is where he had his famous A New Deal speech.
That's correct, and that's why I count this as among the most significant of modern political conventions. It also gets a footnote to history because Roosevelt then, and we're talking about Franklin D. Roosevelt as opposed to Theodore Roosevelt, became the first candidate to address the convention. In the past, it was kind of considered unseemly for the candidate to go to these conventions. He was supposed to be kind of above the fray. And political campaigning, in fact, up until the 1930s, was often really done from your back porch. Famously, Harding and others had just sat on the porch, and reporters would come to them. The idea of barnstorming the country and going around the country and campaigning was seen as somehow ungentlemanly, and it wasn't done. But that was all going to change, as so many things were changing because of the advent of mass media. Radio had come to the fore. And of course, when Roosevelt addresses the convention in 1932, millions of Americans are able to hear this for the first time. And this also changed the roles of conventions in American politics because it became much more of a public spectacle that was carried live on radio and eventually would, of course, be carried live on television.
One of the things I've been thinking about as you've been alluding to how conventions were in the past, especially the very much behind the scenes aspect, you know, it wasn't until recent history that Americans could hear FDR over the radio, and otherwise were definitely not in the room where it happened, so to speak. So do you believe that the average American doesn't really understand the impact or past significance of conventions because it's something that wasn't wildly shared? You know, we see voting as a central part of our participation in a democratic process, but a lot of people don't really know what happens at a convention besides, like, maybe the nominating speech or what comes of a convention.
Right. You know, in the pre-internet, pre-cable television days, the big deal was that networks were going to offer gavel-to-gavel coverage, as they would put it in those days. And for, you know, 3 or 4 nights, the nation really did pay attention to these conventions, the build-up, the nominating speeches, because these candidates typically had not been determined yet, and then the roll call of the ballots as each state got up to deliver its choices for the nominee. And there was a tremendous sense of drama built into that, even though in many cases the nominee was already determined or was clearly established, was still this element of a spectacle and a show. And I think that television certainly amplified and magnified that. 1960, before 1960, there had been televised conventions, but most people still didn't have a television. It's not until the 1950s, and then certainly 1960, when John F. Kennedy, who was this incredibly telegenic candidate, gets the nomination, that people are really watching the conventions in a much more realistic way.
So we have 1960 as the first widely televised convention. And this also set the stage for the first televised debate with John F. Kennedy. And then with the 1968 Democratic National Convention, the attention was drawn not necessarily just to what was happening inside these convention halls, but television also played a huge role when large protests were formed outside of the Democratic National Convention facility in Chicago. Can you explain the significance of that?
Yeah, it's again, it's a moment that I remember living through very clearly as a young man. I was still a teenager, but very much politically aware. And certainly we have to reflect for a moment on what 1968 meant. It was the year in which first we had the Tet Offensive. The Vietnam War was going on, and Americans had been told for years by Lyndon Johnson and his generals that the light was at the end of the tunnel and it was almost over and we were going, the victory was around the corner. The Tet Offensive comes and completely shatters the illusion and the lies that have been given to the American people. Shortly after that, Lyndon B. Johnson, who is the sitting president, elected by a landslide in 1964 after having succeeded Kennedy, withdraws and decides he's not going to run again. It was a stunning moment, largely because of a primary, the primary in New Hampshire, in which the anti-war candidate, Eugene McCarthy, didn't defeat Johnson, but came close. And this was a stunning moment. So Johnson withdraws. Within a few weeks of that withdrawal, we have the assassination of Martin Luther King. Robert F. Kennedy speaks about that assassination and calms the nation. And a few weeks later in June, he is also assassinated. So it was against this backdrop of the war going bad, Lyndon Johnson's withdrawal, the assassinations of these two extraordinary figures in American history, that the Democrats go to Chicago and they are going to go in the midst of a major anti-war demonstration that became a full-scale riot, a riot which later on was determined was really set in motion by the police. It was described as a police riot. And newsmen who were on the floor of the convention covering the convention were actually rough-handled or manhandled, and in some cases, if they were out on the street, beaten. A kind of precursor to what we saw in 2020 in Portland and other places as news media covering protests became part of the violence against the protesters. That happened in 1968, and of course, it was an extraordinary moment in American history. and produced Hubert Humphrey, Johnson's vice president, as the Democratic candidate that year. He lost in a very, very close race, of course, to Richard Nixon.
So speaking on a little more recent history, relatively speaking, what kind of impact have these most recent conventions had?
Well, the most important thing to realize about more recent the conventions since the late 1990s into the early 2000s is that the primary system then had really come into the fore. And in most of these cases, the nominees were determined before the convention meets. The convention takes on a different importance because of who was speaking in a way. Now, keynotes have always been significant, but it's hard to remember too many keynote speeches. Although I remember Bill Clinton giving one a while ago, and it was dreadful before his election when he was still the governor of Arkansas. And many people thought it was the end of his political career. It was such a bad speech. On the other extreme, you have 2004, and a young senator from Illinois, a freshman senator from Illinois, is introduced to the American people, of course, Barack Obama. That convention really propels Obama to national stature. And of course, it would be a few years later that he would win the nomination, again, in a pretty much determined before the convention meets because of the primary system. With Obama's defeat of Hillary Clinton in the primary season. So by 2008, the primary has taken precedence over the convention, and it's increasingly just seen as this celebratory moment, a moment to bring the party together behind the candidate to try and get some sense of unity, and put on a great big show that gets everybody excited to go out and campaign. And that's what the convention had essentially evolved into by the early 2000s.
Kenneth Davis is the author of the Don't Know Much About History series. He's also written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Smithsonian Magazine. He joined me in 2020. With the convention coming to Milwaukee in July, you can help shape our coverage by filling out our election survey. You can find a link at WUWM.com. What you tell us will help inform the stories that you hear leading up to and during the convention on Lake Effect and WUWM. In about 10 minutes, we'll look at some of the best hikes you can find here in Wisconsin. But first, if you've seen an influx in brown, speckled, arrowhead-shaped bugs crawling around your home, you're not alone. We'll learn what they are and how to handle them coming up next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Have you seen this bug? It's about 2 centimeters long with a flat, speckled brown body shaped a bit like an arrowhead with 6 skinny legs and long antennae. It's known as the brown marmorated stink bug, for good reason. Picking it up or moving it will cause the bug to expel a smelly liquid. The stink bug has become an increasingly common sight in Milwaukee homes. And to learn why, Lake Effect's Joy Powers is joined by Russ Groves, the chair of the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison.
Coming into this conversation, I don't think I've ever said this before in an interview, but I do have a bias in this conversation. I hate these bugs. I don't know what they are. I don't really know where they came from, but I know I don't like them. So let's dig into those really basic questions. What are these, you know, this specific type of stink bug, and where did they actually come from?
Sure. Well, it's an exotic and invasive species. So it was introduced into North America actually decades ago. It's come in to the East Coast, and it's really been slowly making its way across the US. It's generally a hitchhiker, meaning that it gets inside of people's vehicles and so forth. And that's what it's really done to sort of travel across the country, basically from east to west. And in the last, I think it's been about a decade, have we started to see adults of these insects arrive. And so in most cases, they arrive like in a vehicle or they arrive in some kind of transport. So they often come into urban areas is where we see them first. And they are in a group that we call pentatomids. You probably would know them as stink bugs, but they're certainly generally innocuous to people, like Asian lady beetles that want to come into the house in the fall. They really don't hurt anything other than they can come in very significant numbers, but they can really be damaging to ornamentals and even agricultural crops.
That was one of my big questions about them, because I have found a number of them, full disclosure, in my home, specifically one of my spider plants. It was hanging on the underside of it. So what is the kind of damage they can do to ornamental plants, but also bigger plants that we might be concerned about economically?
Yeah, for sure. So when we're seeing them in the house, much like I mentioned with the Asian lady beetles that have been here for quite some time, what they're trying to do is just find refuge overwintering. So the ones that we see in the house are typically not feeding, even though you might see it resting on like a spider plant, or you might see it resting somewhere in the house. They're in a bit of a quiescence or a resting state. They're overwintering. Even if they're in the warm indoors, they become really kind of inactive. And then in the spring, about this time, they'll want to make their way back outside. And so inside again, we don't often hear much of any damage just because they're not in a feeding state. But a really good question then, outside, they have a very broad host range. In the springtime, they'll generally be getting up into tree species. They have a piercing, sucking mouth part. Even though they're a plant feeding insect, they have a piercing, sucking mouth part that is not that different from like what a mosquito mouth part is, but instead of tapping into people, they're tapping into plants. And so they're tapping into the vascular system of the plant and they're withdrawing, you know, the sugary rich sap. And that's generally what they're feeding on. They can be in a lot of ornamental plants. They can be in tree species in the first, let's say, third of the year. And then they'll kind of start moving out of those species into a real variety of plant species. They'll move into developing fruit in like fruit trees. If you have apples or a peach or something like that in your yard, they'll definitely can get on those fruit. They can get on even your garden vegetables. They can get on tomatoes. They can get on sweet corn. And that's part of their issue, is that they're very polyphagous. They feed on many different hosts, and the damage that they can cause by piercing in and withdrawing can be, you know, really, really significant. It can distort the developing fruit or a vegetable crop. It can cause it to brown and discolor, really rendering a lot of things unmarketable.
So if you're a farmer, this is something that might be pretty concerning, especially if you do something like apples or a variety of other fruits that come from Wisconsin.
Yeah, for sure. We've certainly known where they become established, and they're quite abundant, like out east, in the Hudson Valley or around Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and some of the, you know, the fruit and vegetable growing areas of the East Coast, where they've been established now for, you know, a few decades. Numbers can get really high. And yes, fruit growers are very well aware of the damage that they cause. Here in Wisconsin, we in some ways expect that to happen. We're not quite there yet. The majority of our, you know, finds and established populations are across the southern half of the state. We don't really have that many finds in the northern half or northern third of the state. When you get north of about Eau Claire, or you get north of like the Fox River area, you know, the Green Bay and points north there, numbers start to fall off. And it's probably a combination of two things. It's probably that they just haven't been moved into those areas quite yet. And it just may not be that there's not the, you know, the real diversity or a composition of host plants, you know, on which they feed. But we expect that. We expect their continued increase in presence or prevalence. And a producer just always needs to be vigilant and to be watching and looking. Anytime they start to see any blemish on the crop itself, or if they know they're in an area where, you know, the insects have become established, they should certainly keep an eye out and learn to be mindful, you know, when they're starting to see numbers, you know, increase to a level where they can expect them to be damaging.
Well, and that gets to, I think, one of the big questions people have when they see them in their homes, as you mentioned. They're called stink bugs for a reason. What should you do if you see these little guys invading your home, invading your yard, or, you know, anywhere else that you might be and you see them?
Yeah. My view is it's a personal choice. I mean, they're just, again, taking up harborage through the winter when they're coming into your house. They aggregate, you know, at that time of the year in late September, early October, as like box elder bugs do, or, you know, the Asian lady beetles do. They get active on those warm late summer or early fall afternoons. And again, they're just aggregating and trying to find a place to overwinter. So a lot of them will be in your sills or under your sill plates. They'll be under siding, but, you know, certainly some of them will get into the house. A vacuum cleaner is one way to deal with them. Again, they're really not hurting anything. As you mentioned by their name, if you pick them up, their natural defense, or one of their natural defense mechanisms, is to expel a pungent odor out of their body, and that gives them the name of a stink bug. But other than that, they're really not expected to be, you know, much of an issue in the house. But if you're a gardener or a market gardener, and you're starting to see, you know, significant numbers, and you're starting to see damage in developing crops associated with their presence, then yes, it's time to, perhaps unfortunately, but it might be time to think about a remedy to sort of get them off of the crops.
When we're talking remedy, is that something like a pesticide, do you think? Or is it like slugs where they just smash them, run them over with a, you know, whatever you might have on hand?
Well, sure. I mean, if numbers are such that, I mean, if you're in the garden a lot, you can certainly pick them. You can just pick them off. They're easy to find. That's exactly right. You can pick them off. But, you know, for some people, especially if it's a small orchard, they just may not have the luxury of being able to pick them, you know, at that kind of level. There isn't a lot of, I would say, really successful non-chemical approaches. There have been lots of interesting, like, thinking about researchable opportunities of what we call attract and kill technologies, where if we use something to attract them in, we can aggregate them and maybe kill them in that way. Even to some extent, people using lights or certain types of light traps, and lots of ongoing investigations, no question. But if a producer does need to resort, you know, to using a type of pesticide, they can reach out to the local pest control. They can reach out, it's in the case of, you know, a house situation where somebody just can't tolerate numbers. From an agricultural standpoint, they can reach out to county extension, or they can reach out to state specialists like myself to get a recommendation on, you know, what options might be available depending upon what their market is.
Sure. Well, Russ, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, sharing your expertise and digging into these bugs a little bit.
Well, again, Joy, I appreciate it. They're actually interesting things to research and sort of watch, especially those that are sort of invading their way across the state.
Russ Groves is a professor and the chair of the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2022. Spring has sprung in Wisconsin, and the weather has finally warmed up enough that we can get out and enjoy the outdoors. If you're looking for a place to stretch your legs and shake off the winter, Kevin Revelinsky has a list of places to check out. He wrote a hiking guide for Milwaukee Magazine last summer, and that's when he talked to Lake Effect Sam Woods.
The guide starts, of course, with Milwaukee area hikes, while I was the author of Best Hikes in Milwaukee, they had somebody on staff who could do that part. But so they contacted me about doing the hikes that were further out, you know, around the state. I'm in Madison, so there's a lot of stuff around here too. So I had to sort out things that would be worth, you know, making a long drive to get to. And along with that, there's some information about long hikes, you know, like backpacking. You know, a lot of people think of the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail. Well, we've got two national scenic trails here in Wisconsin, the Ice Age Trail, of course, and also the North Country Trail. So a little bit about that and just, you know, my philosophy about, you know, how important it is to be outdoors, you know, in terms of physical health, but also mental health. and just having a nice day out in the green space. In terms of the difficulty, you know, that's always a trick for some people. They will say a steep hike is nothing if they didn't have to put their hands down. But other people, you know, like something that's very level or need something that's paved. So that's always a tricky one. So we even have a little, you know, section about that, a little sidebar about how difficulty is determined.
Yeah. One thing that I've learned about myself as a hiker is that personally, I'm a slow hiker. I'm always on the lookout for interesting plants and bug life, and I'll stop Sure. frequently to, you know, feel an interesting looking plant or watch a ant trail or a little wasp burrowing or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's really Right. what I love about hiking is the kind of you can go at your own pace. So I'm curious about you as someone who has, you know, done this for a while. You know, not just what trails do you like, but how do you hike?
I like to think of it as having sort of a split hiking personality. I do go out for the exercise for sure, physical and mental clears the head. But so I tend to be a very fast walker. But at the same time, if I see something interesting, I just, you know, I screech to a halt, and now I might spend 5-10 minutes trying to identify a plant using apps off the phone, or, you know, my own knowledge, or harvesting a mushroom that I know is delicious and edible. Important part there.
Very important.
And
yes.
Photography, you know, and that's changed, of course. I don't have to lug a giant camera anymore. I can use my phone. So it's really a mix of both. So I'll go out with, you know, a time frame in my mind that, well, it would take me this long to hike that trail. And of course, it's never right, because I failed to take into account the 15, 20, 30 times that I stopped and heard something or saw something, or, you know, identified a bird, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, kind of back and forth. And then I'm off to the races again.
Yep. Well, on that note of surprises and new encounters within a hike, is there a hike in Wisconsin that surprised you?
Well, I can think of a couple offhand. One was very recent. Last weekend, I was in Washington Island, and there's not a lot of terrain there. It's a small island, but the Door County Land Trust has these great properties that have rustic trails through them, and there was one that headed out to the only lake on the island called Little Lake. And it was a very short hike, maybe 0.8 miles round trip. And I expected to, you know, go through the woods between two private properties with those threatening signs that say stay on the trail or else kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I get to the lake hoping to see birds or just something pretty. But at that point where the trail turns left into this lake about 20 feet away, to the right is an equal distance to Lake Michigan. So I had no idea that the two lakes were that close together. So you're essentially standing on this awesome isthmus between the two that is clearly made from cobble and these limestone rocks that are just thrown up by the storms and the waves off of Lake Michigan. And that's probably how the thing was formed. Maybe it was a little inlet at one time, but there's this line of rock that's now covered with trees. So that was a surprise. Typically, I'm not surprised because I'm going out and I've Googled all the information or called the people I need to call because I'm doing it for work, and I know what to expect when I get there. Well, years ago, I made a mistake. I got the wrong information. And I was going to put what I thought was a 12-mile hike into my 60 Hikes Madison book. And I had somebody waiting to pick me up at the other end because just I didn't have enough daytime. And he was with his kids waiting. So there was pressure on me to be there on time because they were getting squirrely. So I get out on the hike and I get all the way from Merrimack all the way to Devil's Lake State Park, up over the two bluffs, and then across the north and going to Parfrees Glen. That's not 12 miles, it's 18. So I found myself at the 12-mile mark somewhere midway through the hike thinking, oh, man, and now they're waiting for me. And I ended up basically jogging the rest of that hike to try to get there on time so they weren't waiting for me. And I was wearing hiking boots, so that was a little awkward. bad surprise, I guess, in that case, but an amazing hike, and it's in the book. So
I want to ask about trail etiquette. And so maybe part of trail etiquette is, you know, making sure if you're doing an 18-mile hike that you don't actually think it's a 12-mile hike and have someone waiting for you on the other end. But
that would be rude.
Yeah. But you also have some tips in the guide about trail etiquette that, you know, cover things like pack out what you pack in. So if you, you know, take a lunch with you, don't leave your, you know, don't leave your garbage or some food scraps along the trail, things like staying on the trail. But other than that, how can you be considerate as a hiker to other hikers? And then, you know, the, of course, the place that you're hiking in.
It's just pretty basic advice, leave no trace. And that isn't always garbage. That might be your footprints through something that's been tracked into, beaten into mud, staying on the trail. But also, I encountered a couple of mountain bikers. Some of these trails are shared trails, and the mountain bike people will come through behind you, or hopefully coming at you. And I had a couple of people that were, we could hear for, you know, quarter mile off, because they were playing music on their bikes. So they had like a sound system on their bicycles as they're racing through the trees. And it just begs the question, why are you here? You know, yeah. I love music like the next person, but I think just being, having some humility and realizing that you're sharing the woods, you know, with other people and with other creatures, being a little quieter, I guess. You're going to see more too if you mind your P's and Q's in that regard, because the birds won't fly away. That critter that's on the trail around the bend won't hear you coming, and other hikers won't get angry with you.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask this as, again, as someone who clearly has done a lot of hiking within the state, are there any hidden gems that you think are flying under the radar right now? When I'm thinking of hiking in Wisconsin, I might not think of this place, but in your opinion, I really have to check it out.
That's a good question. I mean, there are a lot of trails that get into the book, so I can't really say that they're hidden, you know. And there are others that I don't include because they're either overrun or we don't want them to be. And the state natural areas, of which there are very many, often have simple rustic trails that have just been made really by local hikers. And those places are excellent. They're typically not on the guidebook route. They can be, you know, short trails or just sort of without trails, where you just hike through the woods, like a cedar forest or something up in northeast Wisconsin, for example. And those are the gems, and you kind of have to look for them. And I encourage people to do that. Look up state natural areas in the DNR's website and find the nearest one. And these are lovely, lovely pieces of nature that are preserved and often feature something that you don't see everywhere else, like a fen or a bog.
Before I let you go, if there's any other final pieces of advice or tips that you have for listeners, I want to give you the chance to leave those before I let you go.
I would say definitely be prepared for your hike and have a plan if weather goes bad, and let people know where you're going. So in case there's a problem, they know where to look for you. Sure. And get out there and enjoy Wisconsin. I mean, this state is rich with a wide variety of terrain and in terms of accessibility. Some of them seem very, very remote. Others are easy to get to for a quick hike because you just happen to have an hour. It's a gold mine, and I encourage everybody to get out and mine it.
Well, Kevin, thank you again for joining us on Lake Effect. Truly appreciate your time and your encouragement to get outside while the weather still allows it.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Kevin Revelinsky is a writer and author of several outdoor guides and nonfiction works. He spoke with Lake Effect Sam Woods last summer. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, but ahead of that, we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com. Then, listen for new episodes starting in May on Thursdays during Lake Effect and Fridays during Morning Edition. Bob Reitman has been on the radio in Milwaukee for decades. He's the host of It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music here at WUWM, but tonight will be the final show.
The whole thing has always been about the music, not about me or any of the other DJs. It was about the music.
We'll learn about Reitman's career from the man himself next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Just let me hear some of that rock and roll music.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. An era comes to an end tonight on WUWM. This evening's episode of It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music will be Bob Reitman's final show. Reitman started his radio career at WUWM in 1966 and went on to work at several radio stations before returning to WUWM in 2007. Here's WUWM's late general manager, Rue Hill, talking about how Reitman got his start at the station.
We had Bob Reitman originally on the air with a poetry show and came to me and said, it's time we do something about rock. I'd like to do it. And I said, rock? And he said, no, come on, Doc. So I said, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. So he claims now that I created his career.
After years of co-hosting It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music with his son Bobby, the pair have decided it's time to play them out. In 2019, when WUWM was celebrating our 55th anniversary, Lake Effect's Bonnie North sat down with Bob Reitman to talk about his career and his love for our station.
I love this station. I love working here. I'm not saying that for any other reason than I really, really mean it. It's close to my heart. I started here, and I've ended up here. And how lucky am I? Wow. You know.
So when you started, were they playing rock and roll at that point?
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I went from a cemetery manager to a poetry readings at the Avant-Garde Coffee House. And I got the chance to do it here. And this guy said, do you want to do that? And I said, are you kidding? Radio? And we did Sense Waves. And my producer was Margaret Moose. She was with, what's his name, from?
Garrison Keillor?
Thank you very much. They were together for quite a while. She was great. But we were doing the poetry show, and then we asked Dr. Hill, Ruane Hill, if we could have 3 more hours to play music. And you know what he said? Sure. Yes, go ahead. I mean, that's the way this place is. It was remarkable, and it was a big break. And we were just having fun playing music. And at that time, when the music, like new albums by the Jefferson Airplane, whoever, there was so much of that, and nobody else was playing it. And we said, we'd like this show, so we did it here, and we got ratings. The music got the ratings. It wasn't us, but we played all that great music, and other FM stations were in trouble. They weren't making money, and WZMF got a hold of us, which shocked me because I was about to go into a teaching program, and they said, how would you like to do a show for us? 6 days a week for $150, and I said, sign me up.
$150 for the whole...
That was my salary.
That was it. Yeah. And it hasn't gotten much better.
Look, I would have done it for $10. I mean, I was so excited. And yes, we ended up on WZMF.
Do you remember the first song you played when you got that extra 3 hours that Dr. Hill gave you to do music? Do you remember what the first song was?
I remember the first song on ZMF. I was doing WUWM with my friend John Coyce. He, along with John Solly and I, had started Kaleidoscope. And I give both those guys, I mean, Coyce was the editor, Solly was the graphics, and I was just there. And I was the poetry editor, but Coyce and I were doing a show here called It's All Right, Ma. I think we called it that back then, too. And we came to a point where he got real busy with the paper, and he said to me, listen, I'm going to go do the paper. Why don't you just do the show? Which just, I mean, I was so into the music and everything, I thought, oh, God, you bet. And Coyce is still my best friend. But the first song, no, I have no idea. See, I should remember that. Anything went, you know, and it was really almost out of control sometimes. Yeah.
I was going to say, okay, 1969, I mean, a lot of great stuff had already come out by then that, you know, came out of early rock and roll, that came out of gospel, that came out of country, that came out of all of those things.
Yep.
And WWM kind of started musically at a really great place.
You're exactly right. And we played a lot of rock and roll and country-flavored stuff. And as the years went on, the heart of our show kind of divided. Artists came along like Steely Dan or artists
big
like,
favorite of mine.
See, they're incredible artists, but to us it wasn't rock and roll. But Fragments were going out there, country over here, R&B over there. And that was interesting. We kept on doing what we were doing because the only criteria we had was, is it good? And will people like this? And so anything went. And I've learned so much after all those years of radio coming over here. I have learned so much about music, found artists that I'd never heard of, music I'd never heard before. But a lot of that has to do with the internet and the places that you can hear music. And it's like this universe that you get shot into. And my God, you know, to the day I'm room temperature, I just learn stuff every day.
You know what I think shows like yours did at that time when there was no internet is that you were sort of a rudimentary internet because the DJ curated all of that stuff and introduced you. If they had the freedom to be able to play pretty much what they wanted, mm-hmm. and they were scouring the record stores and they were getting all of this stuff and they were saying, hey, listen to this. I just found this album, this whatever it is.
Yep.
And, you know, the audience is there thinking, wow, I've never heard that. So in a way, I think what you were doing at that time was introducing folks to things that the internet would do now, that you could go down the rabbit hole of YouTube now.
Yep.
But you couldn't then.
No, you couldn't. And I guess the chance we took was hopefully the stuff we were playing, whether it was recorded 40 years ago or yesterday, we would pick stuff that we really liked. And if it resonated with the audience, it worked. We never were hungry for a massive audience, hoping that a lot of people would listen. But the whole thing has always been about the music, not about me or any of the other DJs. It was about the music. And that phone call I got to come back here after I retired, one of the happiest moments in my life. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
Well, you know, Bob Reitman, let's hope that you and Bobby have many more years of doing music for us here. It's so great that you got your start here.
You know, I hope the station, after we're gone, you know, I would hope that there's more music here all the time, at least in that one time slot on Thursday and repeat it on Saturday. It's only 2 hours, and we have a lot of fun.
Yes, you do, and it's a lot of fun to listen to.
Thank you.
Bob Reitman, we have to do this again.
I get so wound up. I love talking about all of this stuff. And thank you for having me. That means a lot. Thank you.
Bob Reitman is the host of It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music. Tonight's show at 8 p.m. will be the final episode. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Bentz, Lena Tran, Eddie Morales, and Chuck Kornbach from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reevy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.